Bloomberg on the Economy with Mike McKee and Sarah Eisen.
John Reiting is chief economist at RDQ Economics, and he is our guest for the half hour. John, leverage off of what Dave was saying and ask you where we are, you think, of the deleveraging process. Are we starting to see a dangerous upturn in the fact that people are using credit cards again?
No, I don't think so, but I do think we are more than halfway through the deleveraging process. And that households are beginning to feel in a little bit better shape, both about their financial position and about maybe what their house is going to be worth in a couple of years' time. I do get a sense from the housing numbers that the situation in the housing market's beginning to improve a little bit, and maybe this year we won't see house price declines, and that will tremendously reassure households whose major worry on the debt side is that their mortgage is going to be worth more than their home is.
What's driving this newfound momentum in both housing and consumer confidence?
Well, I think, first of all, it's the longevity of the recovery. Albeit
it's just gone on too long. It's time to change.
People finally begin to believe in it, right? It started in June of 2009. We're now here in January of 2012. So the recovery has gone on for more than 2.5 years. We've seen a pickup in job creation at the end of last year. We've seen the unemployment rate fall to 8.5%. We have seen a decline in jobless claims. The four-week average of jobless claims has been below the 400,000 mark for 10 straight weeks. So all of these things are straws in the wind that the economy is getting better. Still not fast enough for most people's tastes, but nevertheless, the economy is getting better, and we're in a better position now than we were 12 months ago.
You have to like the home numbers today. The inventory numbers catching everybody's attention.
Well, yes, I'm a little skeptical about how useful the inventory data are on existing home sales, which showed them at the lowest levels in over half a decade. The reason for that being that those are the homes that are on the market, and they don't reflect the inventory of homes that are being held off the market that may come onto the market through foreclosures. So I think there's still a significant shadow inventory of homes that aren't showing up. But on the other hand, people are buying houses. And we've had three pretty good months of increases in home sales and slowing in home price declines. And of course, that home price decline is a measure of what we're buying now compared to a year ago. And to some extent, it reflects that we have cheaper houses transacting, with smaller houses transacting, as well as the price of houses coming down. So I think down 2.5% year over year on the median home sale for single family homes is a fairly encouraging reading on house prices.
How long do we have to wait until we see the housing market substantially contribute to growth again?
Oh, you could ask me the same question in 12 months' time, and we still won't know what the answer to that.
Years and years.
Because we do have a substantial inventory of homes to work through. And we have to see a pickup in household formation rates, and household formation rates have still been relatively low because of the number of people who've moved back in with their parents in terms of younger families, younger kids. And that requires further improvement in the jobs market. So I think it's going to be another couple of years before we work through the backlog of homes. Having said that, I think that the rate at which we're building houses is below the replacement rate in the U.S. So we are going to see some pickup in construction activity, albeit fairly modest, in 2012. And we will see a small contribution. And at least housing won't be subtracted from growth as it was doing sizably a couple of years ago.
If not housing, what's driving the economy these days? What's responsible for this at least slight turnaround we're seeing?
I think it's profits. I think that the standard economic analysis puts too much emphasis on sources of demand, puts too much emphasis on consumer spending, and not enough on what are the incentives. And the strongest component of the recovery has been the recovery in corporate profits. And that recovery has taken profits to the highest share of GDP since 1950, if we look at the economy as a whole. So companies are doing well. And although they have been cautious, strong profits provide the inducement to invest in new equipment and the inducement to invest in people. And I think that it is profits that have enabled the U.S. economy to be durable, to weather the shocks that we had last year of the pickup in inflation, of the earthquake and supply chain disruption that followed from Japan. The shocks arising out of Europe, and we've weathered those shocks. And companies are still profitable and very liquid. And I think it's profits that are the source of the demand for hiring. And I think next year we'll also see further growth in capital equipment as well.
But isn't a large part of that story just the companies deleveraging themselves and getting leaner and meaner and trimming costs and trying to sort of beef up the earnings that way?
I think that what we have seen is a emergence of a very lean and mean, you should put it, U.S. corporate sector that has made tremendous inroads into efficiency and expanding profit margins in a very difficult environment where top-line growth captured by, let's say, nominal GDP has been relatively modest so far in the recovery. But there comes a point in time where having those profits produces an incentive to and an invest to try and grow. We know that you can't simply hang on to what you've got in the global competitive environment and expect it to be there in 2 or 3 years' time. You only have to think of the names of companies that were giants or potential giants just a few years ago that have fallen by the wayside, especially in the world of technology.
Hiding is the chief economist, co-founder of RDQ Economics. He is joining us for this half hour. And John, obviously, you know, with the economy getting better and the data showing signs of improvement, it raises questions about what the Federal Reserve will do this week. And we know they're going to do a major change in their communication strategy. They told us that. But the unanswered question is, will they do something more in terms of stimulating the economy? What do you think?
I don't think they're going to do anything more in terms of stimulating the economy at this point, although reading through the assessment of the economy that the Fed gave us in the minutes from the December FOMC meeting, I really don't get a sense that they're going to give us a major upgrade in their views on the economy. I think they'll see the economy improving moderately. They'll see inflation moderating. And because of their view that slack in the economy regulates inflation, the majority will probably expect to see inflation moderate a little further. But I think this meeting will be focused on the communication strategy, giving us their assessment of when interest rates will be raised for the first time, which I think when the majority put pen to paper, they're going to push that out of 2013 and probably into 2014. Because of the focus on the unemployment rate, which they will see still only declining at a fairly slow pace over the next couple of years. So I don't think there's a QE3 here, and I think that while they'll reserve the rights in the event that things go sour in Europe and has implications for our financial system to roll out a QE3, I think at this point people just talk about the possible need for it down the road.
That would suggest, if we continue with this, that it's really news dependent. If something happens in Europe, they might have to go back to it, but otherwise it's a dead issue?
Well, the Fed really wants to drive that point home, that policy adjustments are event dependent and are not just unconditional promises. And that was one of the big issues for the Fed in deciding to go to this new communication strategy where the FOMC members give us their forecast not only of GDP growth and inflation and unemployment, but also give us their forecast for where they expect the Fed funds rate to be and when they expect it to be increased for the first time. Because there was a worry that by giving that forecast, people would think that that was an unconditional promise on policy. And the Fed really wants to stress that what they do is conditional on how things unfold. And clearly, in my mind at least, events since the FOMC meeting in early December in the economy have been better especially in the labor market, to some extent in the housing market, on the industrial production numbers, events are better than they were going into the last FOMC meeting. So if they didn't act at the last FOMC meeting, why are they going to roll out and act now? One proviso on that, there were some people who were worried if they were to do something more, that it might be misinterpreted and their ability to do something more might be helped by a communication strategy. So there might be some at the Fed who are thinking the new communication strategy could enable them to do more down the road. But I really think it does take a worsening in the economic data. And thankfully, for the last month or so, we've been on an improving trend.
What about the idea that Sri just told us that the Fed will eventually, Komal Sri Kumar just joined us and said the Fed will eventually have to ease further in order to make up for the European Central Bank's shortcomings when it comes to quantitative easing and fighting its own debt crisis?
I don't see the Fed acting on account of Europe unless Europe poses a Lehman-like systemic threat to the U.S. financial system. The Fed's provided dollar liquidity to the European banks through the ECB, with the ECB being the counterparty risk. But as far as a European fallout, the Fed cannot offset what the European Central Bank does or doesn't do. And in any event, despite what the ECB says, watch what the ECB does. And they're doing closet QE, quite significant closet QE. And they're about to do another round in February when they do the second unlimited three-year loan at 1%. Banks can come to the ECB window, borrow money for 3 years at 1%. Almost $500 billion was taken on the first auction in December. They're encouraging the banks to do it again. And we're seeing yields in Italy, despite the downgrade, falling down at around 6.25% today. It wasn't that long. They were above 7%. So I don't even agree with the characterization that the ECB is not doing it. They're
right.
Not calling it QE, just in the same way that the Fed hasn't called what it's done, monetizing the debt or the deficit, even though it is.
Closet QE. I like that. Where else are we going to see quantitative easing come from? Are we going to see, I mean, China does it, it's completely its own way, but lower reserve ratio requirements, perhaps even interest rate cuts?
Well, the Bank of England's doing it. China will take further actions should GDP growth slow too much. They've got a little breathing space because their inflation rates come down at the last reading to 4.1%. It was above 6% a few months ago. So that's a plus for giving room for China. The GDP growth slowed to 8.9%. And I think if it were to be in danger of falling towards 7%, that would give room for the People's Bank of China to take significant steps to ease policy. But right now, let's face it, 8.9% growth
not too bad.
Isn't bad. In the fourth quarter, on a quarter-to-quarter annualized basis, we now get those numbers or convert them out from the Chinese GDP data. It was around 8.25%. So I don't think they're going to feel a great need to act, but they have plenty of room to act. And the biggest area they have to act is because China's sat on over $3 trillion of foreign exchange reserves. It's a fantastic Bloomberg function, WIRA. You can look at those numbers.
Yes, I know it well.
Interesting thing there. They've fallen since September.
Yeah, well, for the first decline. It was the first decline. This was noteworthy.
Well, I think what it means is that maybe China's exchange rate isn't so undervalued now as people have thought. But those foreign exchange reserves give China tremendous capacity to act if they have to.
All right, we've got to leave it there. Thanks for the global roundup. John Riding, RDQ Economics, our friend on the
Listen to Bloomberg on the Economy weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2011.